The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's nice to see you all here. This is our first week of a five-week series on the precepts, some of the ethical teachings of the Buddha. So I'd like to, during these 5 weeks, hopefully allow for quite a bit of discussion so that it's not simply a one-way street. When we're talking about something like ethics can sometimes be a little bit charged, so I want to allow an opportunity for people to question and to discuss. So when Western teachers came back from Asia 25 years ago, 30 years ago, with these Buddhist teachings, they primarily emphasized the meditation aspect of the teachings and didn't so much talk about the ethical guidelines that the Buddha provided. And Tan Jeff, one of the monks who comes and teaches here, Tanissaro Bhikkhu, killing living beings, to refrain from taking what is not given, to refrain from misuse of sexuality or sexual misconduct, to refrain from false speech, and to refrain from intoxicants. So the practices, these practices really put us into the field of our relationship with others. So this isn't so much about just us. It's really about how we interact with the world. These principles or these precepts are really based on the principle of non-harming. Non-harming our fellow beings. So the guidelines, or these training rules, really, the term in Pali that's translated as precept, really means training rule. So these training rules, or training guidelines, offer a way to harmonize our speech and action with what is in line with our, actually in line with our true interests. They emphasize a movement towards peace, towards contentment, towards mutual respect. And this is really in our own benefit as well. It's not just for others that we take on these practices, because once we start really paying attention to our experience and bringing mindfulness to our experience, and these practices, these precepts, and working with these precepts is completely intertwined with mindfulness. And I'll be talking about that a lot during these 5 weeks. As we pay attention to our experience, we find that if we break these precepts, if we engage in lying or stealing, we find that our mind becomes agitated and that we suffer. So really, the precepts are not only about protecting others, but they're also about protecting ourselves, protecting our own minds from agitated, regretful, remorseful states. So again, back to this term, sila, virtue, ethics. There's three levels of meaning of this term. The most comprehensive is what we might call an inner virtue, which reflects the mind that is, that has the qualities, that has virtuous qualities, such as kindness, truthfulness, patience, compassion. So inner virtue, the having those qualities, that's one form of the virtue. Another form is the outer manifestation of that, the actions that are a result of that inner virtue, the manifestation of these inner qualities is also called virtue. And the third meaning is rules of conduct, which is what I'm really going to be talking about in these 5 weeks. So to tie these three together, the inner virtue is what we might say is the aim of the training. And its manifestation is this outer conduct that is virtuous. But the way we get there is by these rules of conduct. It's really the means by which the aim is achieved. So when we look at these precepts, even the way they're stated, you know, they really kind of remind us of the Ten Commandments in some way. You know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. I undertake the precept to refrain from killing. I undertake the precept to refrain from stealing. That's the way they're phrased in the Buddhist terms. I undertake the precept. I undertake the training rule to refrain from killing. I undertake the training rule to refrain from stealing. But in the Buddhist sense, in this, the way it fits into Buddhist practice, they're not really meant as strictly moralistic commandments. They are really basically practical suggestions regarding our actions and statements about which actions will tend to lead us towards suffering and which actions will tend to lead us away from suffering. The whole basis for Buddhist practice, what helps us, what supports us to get to lead us away from suffering. And these precepts are part of that movement. So the basis of ethics in these teachings has more to do with cultivating clarity of mind and clarity of intention, and not so much to do with right or wrong. When we start paying attention to our actions, we learn for ourselves that certain actions will lead us to more agitation, regret, remorse. So just imagine, and I'm sure most of you have had the experience of lying to a friend. What happens to the mind when you do that? I mean, sometimes, you know, you might even do it for the purposes of hope, of trying to avoid hurting them in some way. But then you're caught in this lie and you need to make sure that you hold that up somehow. So the mind becomes unsettled around that person and maybe even tries to think about, well, who else might talk to that person? And will they tell them something other than I told them? And, oh, I maybe better tell them not to tell that person this thing. So the mind starts to get agitated. So as we begin to see how these actions, what their consequences are, we begin to see that what's good for others is not that different than what's good for ourselves. So that by taking care of ourselves, we take care of others, and by taking care of others, we take care of ourselves. So they're not meant so much to be commandments that are followed blindly, but they really tie into the mindfulness practice. We commit to following these guidelines. When we take the precepts, we commit to doing the best we can to follow these guidelines. But they're not meant so much just as a restraint, a simple restraint on our activity. They do serve as that. They do help us to remember, oh, I'm committed to not taking what is not offered, not taking what is not given. I'm committed to that as a precept. So it can help us to stop action, to have taken these precepts. But it doesn't stop there, actually. It goes a little deeper than that in this teaching. Because what these help us do, they can serve kind of as what I might call mindfulness bells, reminders to pay attention. If we find ourselves right on the brink of getting ready to tell a lie to a friend, it can serve, this precept can serve as a reminder to wake up. Check out what's going on in the mind right now. Pay attention. What is the intention here? What is the reason why this action is being pondered? So these precepts are really a suggestion about observing our minds. This is really how it links in to the cultivation of positive qualities. Each of these precepts has a positive quality that is cultivated along with it. So the first precept, refraining from killing, cultivates compassion. The second, refraining from taking that which is not given, cultivates contentment. The third, refraining from sexual misconduct, cultivates fidelity, harmony in relationship. The fourth, refraining from lying, cultivates truthfulness, honesty. And the fifth, refraining from intoxicants, cultivates clarity of mind. So as we explore these precepts in our practice, not simply as rigid rules, but as kind of a curiosity, it can really help to be light and get curious around this, not to beat ourselves up when we see ourselves on the brink of breaking one of these precepts, but to become curious. What's going on? Pay attention. They're calls to wake up. And that attention to our minds as we're working with these precepts is one of the ways that these positive qualities become cultivated as we work with these precepts. So sometimes people object to the negative phrasing of the precepts. Why does it have to be stated, don't do this, don't do that, don't do that? It does begin to feel like the commandments that way. And this is California, you know, we really do like things to be in positive terms. So there's a good reason for the precepts to be stated in the negative, but I do know teachers that do teach an alternative. In fact, I was just at a retreat center, and they had alternative versions of these teachings, of these precepts. Can't find them. Well, they went something like, for the first one is, I vow to practice compassionate action. Oh, here it is. I undertake the practice of compassionate action. I undertake the practice of contentment. I undertake the practice of responsibility in all my relationships. I undertake the practice Well, in this case, it's of noble silence because it was a retreat center. And I undertake the practice of caring for my body and mind. If we phrase them in this way, they kind of sound better to us, but they're actually harder to follow. They're more vague, and they are actually larger, more encompassing. If we really want to practice compassionate action, that's way more difficult, actually, than practicing refraining from killing living beings. It becomes less achievable. These precepts are meant to be achievable. They're meant to be something that we can actually accomplish, something we can work with in a very clear-cut way. They offer very clear guidelines on some very specific areas. So one teacher has a beautiful response to this question about why they're phrased in the negative. And I can't improve on this, so I'm going to read it to you. This is by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is one of the main translators of the Pali teachings into English. And he's a brilliant mind and a wonderful teacher. So he says, the question still comes up, if there are two sides to each moral principle, why is the precept worded only as an abstinence? Why don't we also undertake training rules to develop positive virtues such as compassion, honesty, and so forth? The answer to this is twofold. First, in order to develop the positive virtues, we have to begin by abstaining from the negative qualities opposed to them. We cannot cultivate compassion while at the same time indulging in killing, or cultivate honesty while stealing and cheating. At the start, we have to abandon the unwholesome through the aspect of avoidance. Only when we have secured a foundation in avoiding the unwholesome can we expect to succeed in cultivating the factors of positive performance. The process of purifying virtue can be compared to growing a flower garden on a plot of uncultivated land. We don't begin by planting the seeds in expectation of a bountiful yield. We have to start with the duller work of weeding out the garden and preparing the beds. Only after we have uprooted the weeds and nourished the soil, can we plant the seeds in the confidence that the flowers will grow healthily. Another reason why the precepts are worded in terms of abstinence is that the development of positive virtues cannot be prescribed by rules. Rules of training can govern what we have to avoid and perform in our outer actions, but only ideals of aspiration, not rules, can govern what develops within ourselves. Thus, we cannot take up a training rule to always be loving towards others. To impose such a rule is to place ourselves in a double bind. Since inner attitudes are just simply not so docile that they can be determined by command. Love and compassion are the fruits of the work we do on ourselves inwardly, not of assenting to a precept. What we can do is to undertake a precept to abstain from destroying life and injuring other beings. Then we can make a resolution, preferably without much fanfare, to develop loving kindness and apply ourselves to the mental training designed to nourish its growth. So I really come from that side. I really like to emphasize that these are actions that we're working with, and that while we're working with them, we may still have mental qualities that are opposed to them, and that's okay. That's the work we're doing. We're purifying our minds. We're supporting the cultivation of these beautiful qualities of compassion, of honesty, of contentment, of clarity. So within the context of the overall training of practice, I mentioned earlier that the Buddha taught first this ethical foundation. In fact, he taught, it's a very common teaching called Sila, Samadhi, Panya as the direction for our practice. Sila meaning ethics, Samadhi meaning mental cultivation, meditation or concentration, and Panya meaning wisdom. So starting with the foundation of ethical conduct, upon that base, we can cultivate our minds and develop our minds more fully to the point which wisdom becomes manifest. So how is this understood? And sometimes it's taught as a sequential teaching, Sila, Samadhi, Panya, ethics, concentration, wisdom. But it's not really meant to be that we completely purify our virtue, that we never break any precept at all before we engage in meditation. In fact, meditation and this practice of the precepts really support each other. As we cultivate our meditation, our mindfulness gets stronger. As our mindfulness gets stronger, we can more easily engage in these practices of looking at our virtue, looking at our ethical conduct. These ethical teachings, these precepts, are really daily life practices. They're not so much what we engage in when we sit down on the cushion, because we're not interacting with others when we're sitting on the cushion. Almost by definition, when we sit down on the cushion, we are refraining from all of these actions, and our virtue is pure in that moment. In that intention of sitting down to meditate, our virtue is pure. Our intention is to cultivate our minds. So when we move into the world and start interacting, that we need to look at this. And the mindfulness needs to be strong. It needs to be able to notice when we're getting ready to lie or perhaps take something from work that doesn't necessarily belong to us or isn't meant to go home. So they support each other, the meditation and the ethical training. Now, as we work in the meditation also, sometimes we start to see, as the meditation deepens, it's kind of like this spiral inward in terms of the purification of our virtue. That as our virtue becomes stronger, we can go deeper in our meditation. And as we deepen in our meditation, we uncover yet more areas where, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. So they work in step, in sync, these two practices. Sometimes when you go on a meditation retreat, sometimes out of nowhere, it pops up. All the things you did when you were 5 years old, you know, those little nasty remarks you said to your neighbor. And there's a great sense of regret. And that's actually a form of the purification of virtue. And we start to see how agitated the mind can get over these small things. So the two practices really come together. So I'd like to just stop for a few minutes before I go on to discussing this first precept, the precept of not killing. So I'll do one precept a week, but also each week I'll do a little bit of discussion about some general aspect of the teachings of Sila also. There's so much to say about these teachings as a whole, and I've just kind of covered the surface of that. But I wanted to open it up to a few minutes for if there's any questions or comments or anything at all that you'd like to say. Yeah, over here and wait for the mic.
Perhaps you're going to cover this when you continue talking, but I was wondering if the first precept was limited to not harming human beings only, or does it cover the animal kingdom or insects or, you know, everything else?
I will talk about that, and it does cover all beings.
On the precept of refraining from lying, how do we differentiate lying to another from lying to oneself? Is there any difference? How is that differentiated?
Well, the precept itself is meant to be the action of verbal lying to another. So it is. The precept is around lying in relationship. Now, it does begin, we do begin as we look at our minds, we start to see where we have been lying to ourselves. And so it does lead us in that direction of beginning to see it. But in terms of the precept, lying to ourselves is more of a mental thing, and it's not necessarily breaking the precept. Because we sometimes don't even know that we're lying to ourselves. You know, if we're lying to ourselves, there's delusion going on. And that is the whole path of waking up. So essentially, you know, actually one of the biggest lies we tell ourselves is that we exist. And we believe that one, hook, line, and sinker. You know, that there is somebody here to be protected. So the whole process of the path is actually uncovering the delusions of our minds.
You mentioned that when you were sitting that that memories of some childhood incident, you know, where you were inappropriate to your playmates or whatever. I noticed that that's also been my experience, but it's not so much a childhood. It's just that there are problems one causes others that at the time one is totally unaware of. That they have, you know, they have no significance, no meaning. They're just simply a conversation came to pass and nothing was, and then you sit, and then the peace and the quiet, and then the realization that you've caused some, you know, a substantial discomfort and pain for others. And it seems like the meditation itself is the precepts.
The meditation itself does refine and extend the precepts. You know, the precepts are meant to be a little more constrained. I mean, in that situation where you describe it, you know, you're not even aware at the time that you're causing harm. But when the mind gets quiet, it does settle into more subtle levels where we actually begin to feel more the connection that we have with others and the impact that we have on others, and we get more sensitive to it. And then we do see the harm that we cause others. And that's it can be a beautiful thing. You know, often we take that and beat ourselves up with it. That tends to be our approach. But it can also be something where we use it to connect again, to go back to that person and say, you know, I realized last night how hurtful that was, and I'm really sorry. You know, to go back and then make some kind of amends so that we can, again, deepen further in our meditation. So, you know, the meditation, you're right, the meditation does serve to clarify those things for us. So hopefully we can use that to then go back and close the circle and connect again.
So that brings up a good question. How does one, when one breaks a precept, not then subject oneself to beating oneself over the head?
Yeah, that's a good one. I will talk about that a little bit more later in the session, but I'll just give a little bit for that right now. It's true, we have such a tendency of like beating ourselves up, and we seem to think that somehow this is like, you know, this is the right thing, you know? If we've done something wrong, we're supposed to flog ourselves because that way we won't do it again. Well, the instructions are basically to notice that we've broken the precept, to resolve that we will do better in the future, to resolve that we'll try to keep our eyes out for that situation and not break it again. So to resolve again, essentially take the precept again. And it can also help to make amends. So to go and to talk to that person and say, you know, I see this was a problem. Now, for me, I found still, you know, even doing those things, I was still beating myself up. And I talked to one of my teachers about it. It was on a long retreat, and I was in Burma. And I went to my teacher, and I had said something to him that could have been that was it wasn't exactly truthful or untruthful. It was right on the edge, but you know, right in that moment, it was funny because I said the thing. And knew it was slightly off. And then I started beating myself up about it and then realized, oh, but actually it was true. But I hadn't actually seen it from the true angle when I was speaking it. So it was very convoluted and I was really beating myself up about it. And I went to the teacher and I confessed. I told him, you know, what had happened and what I had said and how it was not true in the moment and yet true in actuality. And he said, well, you need to take the precepts again. And I said, I've done that. And he said, well, take them in front of me. So I set the precepts in front of him. And the thing he said in that moment was, now your sila is completely purified. And just his saying that made me realize, oh, I've been hanging on. I've been hanging on to this issue. So there is a way in which we have to let go of once we have seen our mistake, made our amends, and made the resolve to move on, we really have to just let go of those mistakes. So it's a challenge for us. It's definitely a challenge.
Hi. I once had a teacher who talked about the four R's. Remember the incident. Get in touch with your regret about the incident. Resolve not to do it again. And then take restorative action. And we can't always go back and make amends.
Yes.
But in this particular practice, there was mantra work. And so it was, you know, it was considered appropriate to go and do a session of certain mantras.
Yes.
You know, take a meditation or do some loving kindness practice or whatever that's intended to work on that particular issue and then let it go. So that one worked for me, the four R's.
That's beautiful. That's very beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for that. So we should move on to the next part. So the precept for refraining from killing. So Ajahn Sumedho, to answer your question, Ajahn Sumedho, who is one of the who's the senior most Western monastic teacher in the Thai forest tradition, says that for lay people, primarily this precept does mean not killing human beings. So that's his interpretation of it. But I've actually gone back to the suttas and tried to find out where it says. For lay people, this means not killing human beings. And I can't find it. So I have to say that the precept as written in the suttas, as far as I can tell, refers to refraining from killing any breathing being. But even if we just committed to refraining from killing human beings, just that part of it, even that is no small thing. I mean, it may seem like a small thing, because not many of us are really in the position of doing that or wanting to do that. But imagine, just imagine what the world would be like if every single person on this planet vowed to not kill another human being. That is not a small thing. War would cease. So allow yourself to rejoice in the wholesomeness of that aspect of your commitment to this first precept. But as I said, the more classical definition includes refraining from killing any breathing being, is the term. Breathing being. And this is much more of a challenge for us. It includes animals, it includes insects, it includes snakes and reptiles. And if we expand our understanding of breathing beings to include bacteria, which I don't know, I mean, it becomes impossible, actually. And, you know, I don't know how the Buddha would think about that. You know, I don't think they knew about bacteria 2,500 years ago. And he included medicine as one of the four requisites. I believe he included medicine as one of the four requisites for monastics. So medicine was certainly allowed for monks. So I don't know how he would treat bacteria, viruses. But I think for our purposes of our discussion, we'll leave those out of the discussion. It's just impossible. I mean, you know, food we consume has bacteria in it. I mean, yogurt, you know, it's like, how do we refrain from killing all of these microscopic beings? So, for the purposes of our discussion, maybe we could say any beings you can see might be our definition. So the definition also includes volition or intention. And I'll talk a lot more about volition and intention next week in the more general terms. But the commentaries say that the taking of life in terms of this precept means the volition or the intention to kill expressed through body or speech. So that the taking of life in terms of this precept has to include the intention to kill. So this might seem like a fine point, but I'll give an example. Suppose you're in your house and you see a spider on the wall and you pick up your shoe and you whack the spider. There's an intention behind that, to kill, to get rid of the spider. The inconvenience of the spider is in your house, wanting to get rid of it. There's the intention behind that action. Now suppose you're walking across your lawn and you step on a spider and you kill it. There's no intention to kill in that situation. You may not even know the spider is there or that you've stepped on it. So the mind state of these two situations is very different. One involves some degree of aversion, of hatred, of hostility, and some delusion. That action to kill the spider. The other, you're not even aware of the spider. So they're very different mind states. So this aspect of the teaching does really, again, underscore the fact that the precept isn't compromised while we're still struggling with hating that spider, while we're still struggling with unskillful states of mind, with aversion, with anger, with hostility. So the precepts are about our actions and avoiding the actions that are coming out of those intentions. And the precepts are not compromised if that mind state is there. If we really want to kill that spider, but we recognize, I really want to kill that spider, and we pay attention instead of what that aversion feels like, maybe fear, maybe you have a great fear of spiders. What's going on? Wake up, pay attention to what's actually happening in our experience. The precept is fulfilled. The virtue is being cultivated. So this is where the negative phrasing of the precepts is helpful to us. If we're vowing to cultivate compassion there while we've got this angry mind state, that's harder to do. But we can observe that angry mind state. So there's a lot of gray issues in this as well. I mean, it's a cut and dried teaching. The teaching says to refrain from killing living beings. For lay people, I think perhaps monastics could avoid killing. But in terms of the planet as a whole, there are some gray issues. So for instance, you know, killing malarial mosquitoes, using insecticide on mosquito nets so that children in Africa don't get malaria, or killing chickens with bird flu so that the bird flu doesn't spread to other animals and perhaps to people and create a huge pandemic. So this is an area that we need to explore for ourselves, and really the key comes back to looking at our intention. What is the intention? Really, the intention behind the action is the key piece, the key place where the trajectory of our minds is set. The intention sets the movement of our mind. If we're engaging in an action out of compassion, it sets a direction away from suffering. If we're engaging in an action out of anger and hostility, it creates a trajectory in another direction. So if compassion for the children in Africa is our motivation, that mitigates to some extent the moral weight of the action of killing the mosquitoes. There are gradations. I mean, the Buddhist teachings do talk about various gradations of the killing. And certainly to kill a human being is more morally reprehensible than killing an animal. Killing an animal is more morally reprehensible than killing an insect. So they've got these gradations, and in fact they've got many classifications within these things. Like under animals, it's more morally reprehensible to kill an animal that belongs to somebody than one that doesn't belong to somebody. And vaguely in the category of animals, the larger the animal, the more the worse it is to kill them. So elephants are bad to kill, worse to kill than chickens. So, you know, they've got all of these rules. It's quite amazing. But, you know, what I like to look at is, again, the intention. And also, you know, when is it that we're doing something out of convenience to ourselves? So, for instance, I undertook a practice, still have the practice of not killing the ants in my house. And I undergo some fairly elaborate procedures to have the ants ushered back to their entry point, and to scoop up those that I find left and put them outside. And it can take some time. You know, I come into the kitchen in the morning, there's ants in the kitchen. It's like, okay, this is 20 minutes. You know, so it would sure be more convenient to just wipe the whole counter down with soap. But, you know, I can't do that anymore. So, you know, we really have to look at where is it a convenience issue for us? You know, is convenience really a good excuse for killing? So, you know, just observing in your experience when this comes up. So, I also want to say, I want to point out one teaching in the Buddhist teachings. It's been very helpful to me, and this is the teaching about one monk. His name was Angulimala, and he was a mass murderer. He had killed 999 people before the Buddha found him and stopped him, ordained him. And after he ordained, he became fully enlightened. So what this teaching for me shows is that the Buddhist teachings aren't deterministic in a way that, you know, if you've killed someone, it means you are forever banned from freedom of mind. There's a caveat to that. If you kill your mother or your father or a fully enlightened being, you go to hell. But if you kill someone, Angulimala had killed 999 people, and he could see his moral culpability, work with it, and I can't even imagine what his meditation was like. But it's possible to awaken, even at that level. So it's not deterministic results. And I remind myself of this. I've not done anything near like killing 999 people, but I think, you know, some things that I think about, it's like, wow, you know, am I worthy of becoming enlightened because of these things I've done in my past? And I remember this story. So I use this as a way to remind myself to let go. To let go of the actions in the past. Make the four R's. Yes. You were saying the four R's. So this precept cultivates compassion. Compassion is the quivering of the heart in response to suffering. When the open heart meets suffering, compassion is the natural result. And this precept of not killing connects us to other beings, to other living beings, and we start to see the situation from their perspective. And it begins to open us to cultivate compassion. We start to feel moved by life itself, by just the way, the difficulty of beings in engaging in their lives. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, working with ants in my kitchen, I found at one point that this compassion did come up for me around these ants. It was early in my days when I was just trying to figure out how to work with this, and you know, I had figured out a way to corral them with a ring of soap and find out where they were coming in and kind of work them back with soap. You know, they don't want to cross the line of soap, so you know, they, you know, just progressively making the soap corral smaller and smaller, and they worked their way back. And I was getting a little impatient and started scooping up the ants on the edges of the corral and depositing them closer closer to the place where their hole was. And after doing this a few times, I noticed that the ants started experiencing alarm, or what I took as alarm. I saw one ant near the hole get up on his back two legs and start scanning the environment like this. I had never seen an ant do anything like this before. And that just made my heart open. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, that there is a being there experiencing something like fear. So this practice did point me to compassion. But it's not just enough. I mean, the taking this precept is the beginning of this cultivation of compassion. Once we start to get into intimations of it, we can take on practices that support the cultivation of compassion. Practices that we may, there are meditation practices, cultivation of the mindfulness, of the loving kindness, of the compassion itself. There are formal practices around cultivating compassion. There's also actions we can take in the world, working for hospice, for instance, might be a way to look at cultivating compassion. So being creative with ways to extend this precept, to see, as Bhikkhu Bodhi says, to make a resolution to open our minds towards the cultivation of compassion, to create the conditions that will help to support its growth, to nourish its growth. So we have just a minute or so for more questions about this precept. Karen.
I have a question about, it seems to me that sometimes people do things not so much out of anger or something, but out of maybe indifference, you know, and they could kill something out of indifference. I could vote no on a school bond that meant the children wouldn't get educated. It seems like that's death. You know, people can put toxics into the water supply that could make people sick. So it seems like there's many other things that cause death or is a type of death.
Yes, you're right. That indifference is a huge one, and that's you know, associated with delusion, essentially. So you're right. Absolutely. Go ahead.
Could you speak about the Tibetan monks and the killing that's going on?
In what way?
Well, when does self-defense, I mean, I don't fully understand, I know that there's been killing on both sides, the Chinese and the Tibetans, and I know that there's probably a lot of misunderstanding out there as to the intent of the Buddhists, of the Tibetans, of the monks that are perceived anyway as being violent.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that the Dalai Lama does not condone any form of violence. So, you know, I'm not sure how that's playing out, if the monks are in self-defense killing others. I don't know how that's playing out.
So is self-defense another...
It's one of those
gray areas.
It's one of those gray areas. Yeah, it's one of those places where if you're killing in self-defense, again, it has to do with the intention, the moral responsibility has to do with the intention that you know, if the intention killing somebody out of hatred is very different than killing somebody out of self-defense. You know, that so the moral culpability is far less. So again, yeah, it comes back to that intention area. But I think, you know, in the Buddha was pretty, He was pretty strong on this. You know, he said, even if somebody is sawing off your arms, you should not let loving kindness towards them diminish. And the Dalai Lama, you know, he embodies that. You know, that's his aspiration. And, you know, I think he's actually questioned it to some extent. I think I've heard that he's questioned. I don't know if this is right, but I just cannot say that killing is right. So
it just seems like a lot of what you said tonight, that someone, if they really put their mind to it, could condone. You know, you said killing a smaller animal is less morally wrong than killing a larger animal, and who says that? Who's making up those?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, those were made up. I don't know whether they were made up in the Buddhist time, but I think they roughly were, and it had to do with the you know, the guidelines of the day and what they considered more valuable. So again, I think we really need to come back to intention. And that's really where we need to look at in working with these precepts. So we need to stop. So if you're so inclined, you might see if you can take on this precept for this week to the point of not killing any visible beings. And observe what happens. Notice what happens. Just see what happens. May try to start the discussion next week with a little discussion about what has happened for you. So thank you all for your attention and your participation.